to be with you. On My Mind this week, Washington Post reporter Dan Baltz recently wrote, President Trump is governing pretty much as he campaigned. I checked in with him to talk about what this means for our members of Congress.
Are they tied to Donald Trump's standing if people are unhappy with the presidency of Donald Trump? Or is there some separation in the way people will be responding?
Then a conversation with a dear friend, linguist Deborah Tannen, on how friends can best support each other in times of grief.
People really don't want to say the wrong thing, and they don't know what the right thing is to say. I think this is particularly true for Americans. We want to say just the right thing, and so we can't think of the right thing to say.
First, from his desk at the Washington Post, reporter Dan Baltz. Hey, Dan Baltz, it's good to have you with us.
Diane, it's great to be with you.
Thank you. Last week, President Trump marked his 100th day in office with a disapproval rating of 52%. What do you think this could mean for midterms?
Well, if a president is as low at the eve of a midterm election as President Trump is at his 100-day mark, that would normally say Republicans are going to suffer losses and potentially substantial losses. There's no hard and fast rule on this, but if you're in the mid-40s or low-40s as a president, we've seen cases where, you know, with President Obama, he lost 63 seats in 2010. Bill Clinton lost 54 in 1994. In both cases, the Democrats lost control of the House. So it's a worrisome situation if you're a Republican member of the House at this point and looking ahead and wondering what can Donald Trump do to get those numbers up.
On the other hand, Donald Trump is no traditional president. He has not campaigned with traditional means, and therefore one has to wonder whether all the rules or all the indications and traditions are out the window.
Well, that's a really important point, and it's one that I think, you know, all of us have to remember constantly, which is that traditional metrics don't necessarily apply to Donald Trump. I mean, we think back to Election Day when 60% of the people who voted, at least according to the exit polls, said that they did not think Donald Trump was qualified to be president, and yet enough of them voted for him to make him president of the United States. So that's always a caution with him, which is that his ability to defy the kinds of episodes or measures that tell us about other politicians that they're in a weak spot, you know, he continues to defy those norms. On the other hand, I think we do know that midterm elections, particularly the first midterm of a new presidency, those elections are always a referendum on the incumbent president. And so that's kind of the dilemma for House members, not yet today, but as we, you know, as we move from 2017 into 2018, which is, are they tied to Donald Trump's standing? If people are unhappy with the presidency of Donald Trump, will they take it out on House Republicans? Or is there some separation in the way people will be responding? You know, we're just too early to know the answer to that question. But if you're a member of the House and in the Republican Party, I'm sure you're beginning to think about that.
What do we know about the relationship between House Speaker Paul Ryan and the president at this point?
I think everything we know about that relationship, and obviously there's a lot that we don't know, but everything we know about it would suggest that it's a difficult relationship. These are two politicians who are very, very different. Their instincts are different. Their interests are different. President Trump is in no way a deep policy person. Paul Ryan has come up through the policy apparatus. He worked at a think tank with Jack Kemp and Bill Bennett. His work prior to becoming speaker was always focused on a lot of substantive stuff, whether it was the budget and entitlements or taxes when he was Ways and Means chair. he's a more detailed person than the president. And the other thing we know is that throughout the election, there was tension between the two of them. You know, President Trump, or then candidate Trump, from time to time hectored Speaker Ryan, and the speaker made clear at different points when Trump said things that were over the line that he quite seriously disagreed and condemned what the president was doing. And we know that President Trump is somebody who doesn't forget those things. So, you know, they obviously have to work out a relationship that's relatively harmonious. But I think that that will always be a difficult relationship.
Do you see some compromise on the part of the president? I'm looking at the spending bill that apparently is going to Congress without the inclusion of money for a wall.
Yeah, I think one thing we've seen with the president is that his words don't necessarily reflect what his ultimate actions will be. I think Senator McCain said recently, pay more attention to what he does and not so much attention to what he says. You know, that's often kind of hard because things that he says get a lot of attention. But particularly on the budget, what we saw was he made a strong case that he wanted money in there for the wall, or seemed to, and yet it was clear that the negotiations were going on in a way that he wasn't going to get that. Now, you could say that's a big setback for him because the wall is such a signature idea of his presidency and his campaign. But I think if you think of the wall as part of an overall immigration policy, you would say that what he has done on immigration has clearly kind of changed the tone of that issue in the country. And it has set off great fears within the Hispanic community about possible deportations. It has seemingly had a chilling effect on the number of people who are coming across the border illegally. So if you add it all up, you'd say, okay, he caved on money for the wall at this, certainly in this bill to keep the government funded through this fiscal year. But in other ways, he's making an impact on immigration that is significantly different than we saw under President Obama.
What about his tax plan? How much of a chance does that have going forward?
You know, I think any tax plan of that size and significance is going to undergo a lot of changes. Let's step back and look at it from high elevation. Is he likely to get a cut in the corporate tax rate? I would think yes. I mean, I think that's something that Democrats and Republicans have talked about. At what level? I don't know. Will he get the kinds of changes in personal tax rates? I don't know, in part because we don't quite know what those are going to look like. We know what he wants to do in terms of collapsing the rates to three different rates, but we don't know exactly who fits into one rate versus the second rate versus the third rate, and that will have a big impact on kind of how people will evaluate the distribution of benefits of this tax plan. He wants to eliminate a lot of, you know, loopholes, so to speak, including he wants to get rid of the deduction for state and local taxes, which will be a big fight. So I think that there's still so much that we don't know. He put out a tax plan last week, quote unquote, but it was a single piece of paper. So it wasn't what we are used to seeing when an administration comes forward with a plan and a lot of backup material, you know, detailed tables on the, you know, how this affects one group of people versus another, all of the fine print. So we're a long way from that.
I must say the figure that stands out in my mind, and perhaps in most people's minds, is reducing the corporate tax rate from 35% to 15%. How likely is the House to go along with that?
Well, I think the House will push to get it as low as they can in a Republican House. I think it will have more difficulty in the Senate. As I say, I think it's likely to come down, but I don't know that the president can get his way on bringing it down to 15%. I mean, that's just such a big drop. And we've heard even from some Republicans saying, you know, that may be a bridge too far. And so they're certainly taking that under advisement as opposed to embracing it at this point. Diane, there's another aspect to this tax plan, and that is we do not know, because we have never seen President Trump's recent tax returns, what the impact of these changes would be on President Trump. And, you know, Democrats are going to make another hard push to force him to release his tax returns so that there's transparency on what this would do for him and his family. He's going to resist it. I mean, there's no indication that he's softened on the idea of putting his tax returns out in public view. But, I mean, it's an important question that, you know, he'll be pressed on, and it will be part of the debate as the tax bill begins to make its way through the Congress.
So many of us in the journalism field have been focused on the president's first 100 days in office. My question to you is, what have reporters learned from that first 100 days in office, and have any of their approaches changed as a result?
Well, without being overly frivolous, one of the things we've learned is that every day is a new day with this White House, and there is no rest for people who are covering this administration, and particularly those assigned to the White House. The amount of activity that's going on is quite amazing, actually. I mean, the pace that this president is keeping up, just in terms of public events and, you know, executive order signings and all of that, plus his tweets and his statements and interviews, there's just an incredible outflow of information, and some of it surprising and some of it occasionally shocking. And that has kept everybody running. And I think that one of the things we have tried to learn is that while we have to pay attention to that, we have to figure out ways to step back and try to, in a sense, kind of aggregate things and say, well, what does this actually mean? And I think that's been a very challenging aspect to this. I mean, you can look at things that the president has done and say, well, you know, in many ways, he's kind of become a conventional Republican. And you can look at other things he's done and you can say, well, Stephen Bannon, the anti-globalist and nativist nationalist, still has a lot of sway in this administration and in this White House. And so trying to sort that out has, I think, remained one of the biggest challenges that we have as journalists. You know, it's obviously a difficult administration to cover because of the tensions between the president and the press, and he's been continuous in trying to, in essence, delegitimize or undermine, you know, what we do and the credibility of what we do. And we have to work against that, not as they claim as the opposition party, but by just doing the work that we have always done with administrations and trying to keep our heads down and dig in. But it's a tough administration to cover.
Dan, let me move now to foreign affairs issues and the fact that apparently the president has invited the president of the Philippines to come to the U.S. Now, there have been accusations, allegations, or even proven statements that president has been involved in the assassinations or killings of thousands of people involved in drug dealings, drug use, whatever. What do you make of that invitation?
I think, like a lot of people, I was quite surprised by it. And, you have to wonder whether the president was in one way or another essentially freelancing during that call and doing something that his national security advisors would never have recommended. And you just have to wonder how this is going to play out. But, you know, one thing we have observed about President Trump is he seems to have admiration for what you would call in shorthand the kind of strongman leader. And this seems to be another example of that.
Would you believe that he had consulted with his Secretary of State before doing that?
I would hope he would have. You would hope that when he is doing calls with foreign leaders that there is some preparation in advance for that of what you want to get out of that meeting and what ought to be said and what ought not to be said. But, you know, throughout his time in office and certainly during his time as a candidate, he said very little about human rights issues. Those are just issues that do not seem to be on his screen. But, you know, if you're in the State Department after you get the readout of that phone call, you must be alarmed and somewhat demoralized.
You know, it's fascinating considering the fact that Secretary of State Tillerson is sitting atop a building of empty offices. That's why I wonder who's advising President Trump on these foreign policy issues.
Well, we have to believe that Tillerson himself is, and Secretary Tillerson has gotten a lot of criticism for seeming to be absent and not having much of a public face and engaging in public diplomacy. Some people who know him reasonably well think that he has spent part of his time developing a real relationship with the president, which he did not have when he came in. The two did not know one another. And it's important, obviously, for the Secretary of State to have a very strong relationship with the president. So it may be that part of Tillerson's relative absence from public view during the early months of the administration were in part because he was spending time trying to develop that relationship. But you're absolutely right about the State Department itself, him being essentially home alone. Now, there are some capable career Foreign Service officers who he is relying on for some advice, but that building is not populated in any substantial way at the upper levels, and that is concerning. You can't carry out all the work of the State Department by having only the Secretary of State and a few other people. You have to think that on national security matters, H.R. McMaster, the national security advisor, plays a vital role, and I think we believe that Secretary Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, plays a vital role. So there are some capable people around him, but the State Department, as an institution, needs a lot of help.
Dan Bowles, thank you.
Diane, thank you.
And now a quick break. And we're back. And now Deborah Tannen. She's a linguist at Georgetown University, the author of a number of best-selling books. Her most recent, You're the Only One I Can Tell, Inside the Language of Women's Friendships. She joined me here in this studio. Deborah Tannen, how great to see you.
What a great pleasure to see you, Diane.
Thank
it always
you.
Is.
Thank you. You and I have been friends for a long, long time. Your new book about women's friendship touches on what happens when one of those friends gets into a difficult place where there's tragedy, where there's loss, where there's grief. What is the language that occurs between women when that happens?
I think those kinds of times are when both the best and the worst of friendship comes into its own. Let me talk about the best, because that's the most positive side and the part that is so precious to people. So many women that I interviewed, and I talked to over 80 women, and formally and then many others informally, said it was only my friends that got me through. This could be if they lost a spouse, or in some cases, a single person lives alone and is undergoing some kind of medical treatment or has suffered a loss. And the stories I heard of women friends coming through were so moving. You know, she dropped everything, flew across the country, stayed with me for a week, spoke to me every day. I think of a woman who told me her best friend called her every day for a year after her husband passed away. And so many of these stories are just an extreme form of what women do for each other in normal times. She's the one that I talk to when somebody's bothering me. She's the one I call when something wonderful happens. And if there's a group, it can be even more intense, a group of friends that meet regularly and support each other. Then there's the role of talk. And this is what makes women's friendships really unique and different in a way from the typical men's friendships. And anytime I generalize, I always want to add, nothing is true of everybody.
Of course.
We're talking about tendencies. But talk is the glue that holds women's relationships together. And that is something that I said way back in the book, You Just Don't Understand. And so just being able to talk to somebody makes you feel less alone in the world. And it could be talking about really significant things or insignificant things. So I think of a woman who said about someone, you know, we're not such close friends. I wouldn't tell her about the problems my kids are having. This is grown kids. And then the same woman later in the conversation said about someone else, you know, we're really not such good friends. I wouldn't tell her what I had for dinner. And so why is it both the most significant things and the everyday things? Because it's that sense of caring. The person who's interested in what you ate or what you did or where you went and what they said and what you said in response, it's just for many women, and it's not a kind of conversation that is typical for men. In fact, it can strike many men as rather odd. It's just the feeling that somebody cares about you and your life.
On the other hand, women themselves can be less than supportive in hard times. Give me a sense of women who felt let down by their friends.
Yes. And as I answered, I said, when something terrible happens, it's both, you see both the best and the worst. Just about everybody I talked to who had suffered either a loss or a serious illness, themselves or a loved one, said that the friends who came through were not always the ones they expected to come through. Sometimes it was someone they weren't all that close to before, but they became very close as they were supportive in that situation. And then there were friends who they really thought they could depend on, and they disappeared. I think of a woman who was telling me when her husband had Parkinson's and eventually passed away, and I know that is something you lived through yourself.
Indeed.
Yeah. She mentioned a couple. She was very good friends with the woman. Her husband was with the man. And she said the husband just stopped coming by, and his wife said, my husband can't deal with seeing your husband that way.
Oh, wow.
And she said, we had to deal with this every day, and they couldn't deal with it for an hour. If a friend isn't there when you need her, what is a friend? And that is the downside. And then let's think, too, about, I was talking about how significant talk is to many women. It is so easy to say the wrong thing. And it's not as if I could give you a list of the right things to say. There are some things we do know that's been commented on lately. You know, if you say, tell me if there's anything I can do.
Yes.
people do appreciate it as an expression of concern, but it's not going to offer you any help because you're not going to tell them.
Because it puts the grieving person on the spot.
Yes.
To come up with something people said. Exactly. Yes. That to me. What can I do? How can I be of help? And my mind was a blank.
Yeah, your mind is a blank. Making decisions, thinking clearly is not when you're grieving. That is not something you're capable of. And so it's better to offer something specific. If it's an illness, can I drive you to your appointments? Can I be there with you when there's something you need a companion for? I'd like to bring over dinner. What night would be a good night? So something specific. We do know that. But there are so many things that some people would appreciate and others wouldn't. And that was a surprise to me. If it's cancer, I heard so many examples of things not to say if someone has gotten a cancer diagnosis, for example. What stage is it? And a woman I talked to who went through this said, if you say a large number, they act as if you're dead. And if you say a small number, they act as if there's nothing wrong.
Do they also, women as well as men, say what kind of cancer?
Yes, that was not something that anyone mentioned to me as anything they did not appreciate. But all kinds of advice. Never mind chemo. That's rat poison. I'll send you a book about what kind of food to eat or specific drink onion juice or reassurances, which are clearly well-intended. You'll be fine. Stay positive. And these things are not anything you could know. People really don't want to say the wrong thing, and they don't know what the right thing is to say. I think this is particularly true for Americans. I spent some time in Greece, And in Greece, there are certain set things that people say, and they feel satisfied, they feel confident that they're saying the right thing. But Americans feel we should say something original, and we want to say just the right thing, and so we can't think of the right thing to say. It's like at a funeral or when someone has suffered a loss, you'll say there's nothing to say at a time like this because we really don't know what to say. But I do caution people because from the ones I interviewed, it was so clear. The most painful thing is just disappearing. And so just staying in touch, calling, and maybe the most general things. I'm just sorry this is happening to you.
Exactly. Sometimes the grieving person herself may go silent. Then what happens to a friend?
Yeah, I think it's very tempting to say or to think to yourself, I don't want to intrude, I don't want to leave them alone. But people told me they really appreciated people reaching out, maybe continue to send emails or texts or call, even if they don't respond. You know, I'm thinking of you and realize that it's the reaching out that's meaningful.
A time of loss is a time of confusion, conflict, in the sense that one wants people around you, and at the same time, you don't want anyone around you. You want to be alone, and yet you want to be silent within a group. I know that while my husband was in his last days, I just really didn't want to talk with anyone. And I'm sure many women feel that way.
Yes, and people are different. And that's another thing that's hard to get our heads around. What might be the right thing to say in one context to one person might be the wrong thing to another person, or the same person in another context. But yeah, it's that fear of saying the wrong thing that can make us say nothing, and that may not be the right thing either. But just to be able to be there and not talk can sometimes be very helpful. I'm glad this is coming up because just realizing the depth of loss somebody can feel when a friend passes away is significant. We all know about death of a loved one, death of a family member. But I think of people I talk to who suffered the death of a close friend. And I remember one person saying that the worst thing is that she couldn't call up that friend and tell her how terrible she feels about her passing away, because that's what she would do.
My dear friend Trish Fredenberg died while I was in Cuba, so that I found myself, when I heard the news a day or two later, suffering such shock and such internal grief because I could not be not only not with her, but I could not be with her family. So that kind of distance, I mean, makes it all that much worse.
Yes, and I know that. I know that you lost your friend. And I want to say that I just demonstrated what I had kind of said. I wanted to leave it up to you whether you were going to mention your friend Trish's passing, because it was very prominent in my mind, and I was thinking of saying, but I didn't know if you wanted to talk about it. So I left it to you.
I'm glad you did, and I'm glad I am talking about her because it's still so fresh in my mind, her laughter, her constant wit, her love, her, I mean, she gave me so much, Deborah, and now she's gone, and there is and will remain that void in my life. And one wonders, you know, what people say to friends of the deceased. Is that different from what one says to loss of friends of a loved one?
I think it's quite similar. I think what's different is they don't always realize that this should be treated in the same way as the loss of a family member should be treated. And I know I write condolence notes in that context because it's really the same. And it's just so significant, I think, for us to be talking about this because I think friendship, especially women's friendships, has been underappreciated and underobserved in a way because they are one of the things I discovered when I wrote a book about mothers and daughters was that that can be as deep and as complicated as romantic love. And the same is true of friendships. And just as people go to their therapists to deal with issues that they're having with a partner or with a child, they go and talk about issues they're having with friends. Somebody commented to me that 25% of her time with a therapist is talking about a particular friendship that is complicated. And friendships are complicated because people are complicated and relationships are complicated.
How long did it take you to write this book?
I worked on it for a year.
Good amount of time for you to talk with the many people you spoke with.
Yes, I would say about 3 or 4 months was just talking to people and getting a sense of what the patterns were. And then, of course, I have it transcribed and I go over the transcripts and pick out the quotes and examples that seem emblematic of themes that I heard from many other people as well.
And you believe that if a male loses a good friend, do you think the pattern of communication with that friend's family or partner would be different from the way women talk with each other?
There's no question in my mind that a man losing a close friend would feel as much grief. But the role of talk seems to be different, both the role of talk that was part of the friendship and the role of talk in dealing with it. I can't tell you how many men, this is just another context, I talked to who said that when they were facing something difficult or even just having a positive visit with a friend, just being together was healing. They really preferred not to talk. And actually, some of the women that I talked to said that they preferred their hanging around with their male friends at a difficult time because they didn't have to talk. And feeling that women were going to ask them all these questions, and you appreciate the concern, but if you have to talk about it, you're reminding yourself of the pain and the struggle. And sometimes you just want to put that behind you, maybe focus on work, maybe focus on what you're doing. But I think of one woman in particular who said she was going through a divorce, very tough one. Her favorite thing to do was go bike riding with a male friend who was also going through a divorce, and they never talked about it. They just rode their bikes till they were exhausted. And it was a kind of comfort and companionship, but less likely to be talked.
You know, when I learned about Trish Fredenberg's death, I was on this boat in Cuba. And when I learned about it, I sort of went crazy because it was so unexpected. When I left Washington, I saw her the day before I left, and she was brilliant and happy and questioning why she was so sick at the time, but nevertheless optimistic. So when I heard the news, I was so shocked. I was dumbfounded. And what did I do? I sat with two close male friends on that ship, each of whom had their arms around me, and we said nothing.
Perfect, perfect, yeah.
It happens that way.
Yes.
And that was how I could feel, totally feel, what I was going through internally without talking about it. So talking, not talking, sharing, not sharing. Perhaps as we grow older, we change our habits.
Certainly it can change as we grow older, and it can just be different in different circumstances as well. I think. I'm sure there are other circumstances where something might have happened that you would have wanted to talk about. I often say in, you know, everything I write that sometimes there are things women can learn from men and things men can learn from women. And I think this is something that women can learn from men. That is the joy of sometimes being together and not talking. Because talking can be the most wonderful thing in the world, and sometimes it can just be a bit much.
One last question, Deborah. As soon as you heard about the death of my dear friend, you sent me a beautiful email. Email can be seen as very precious, or it can be seen as someone not caring enough to sit down and write a note. What are your thoughts about that?
No, I just want to say I did both. I emailed and then I wrote a note.
Yes, you did.
But I love that question, and I have a whole chapter about these new media, social media, because people have such different feelings about them. So, yes, there are people who feel anything posted on Facebook, for example, is insincere because it's so easy to post on Facebook. And many people do feel that email is an inappropriate medium for sincere expression of sincere feelings. But I spoke to so many people who told me how precious email was to them when they suffered a loss. I remember one woman in particular saying she got hundreds of emails when her husband died. And she said that she felt that they were somehow more, she felt them to be more sincere than what people wrote on cards. It seemed more spontaneous. And she felt she didn't have to reply, which took a burden off her. Now, I'm sure there are other people who would think they did have to reply. And this is one of the challenging things about social media, that people have such different feelings about them. Just a tiny little example. I spoke to two young women who had been very close friends and called each other. You know, after college, they stayed friends. But then when they moved to texting, one of them got upset with the other because she would text about some problem she was having, and the responses she got from her friend were fairly cryptic. And she felt, you know, where's my supportive, understanding friend? And it turned out they simply had different assumptions about texting. The friend thought, you don't talk about things like that on texting. That's for phone calls. I'm showing I'm caring by answering quickly and answering frequently. And the initial one felt that I'm describing my problem that way. You should give me your support that way. I think there's a whole range, but many people did tell me that they did appreciate emails very much.
Deborah Tannen, my dear friend, thank you for being with me.
And thank you, Diane, so much, and condolences on your loss.
Thank you. And for this week from the archives.
He saw what was happening with regard to the Civil War. He said, there's no reason for this.
In an interview last Monday, President Trump suggested that President Andrew Jackson, had he lived longer, could have prevented the Civil War.
People don't realize, you know, the Civil War. You think about it, why? People don't ask that question. But why was there the Civil War? Why could that one not have been worked out?
Contrary to Trump's assertion, the origins of the Civil War and its aftermath have been the subject of intense study and debate for more than 150 years. Here's what historian David Blight, a professor at Yale University, had to say about it on The Diane Rehm Show in a 2011 segment.
Well, Diane, I mean, to your huge question of why are we still struggling so much with this today, that's a huge problem, of course. But if we boil it right down to the two large questions over which this war was fought, the one being slavery and whether it would be destroyed or whether it would be survived, whether it would survive and what kind of new racial regime would come out of that. And the second question being federalism and states' rights. If you think of those two questions together, we have never resolved those two questions, and it's arguable that in many ways we never will. They are part and parcel of what the United States is. And one of the reasons, of course, that we still struggle over this is because that war brought about, as you suggested in your opening, a kind of second revolution. It was a rending. It was a transformation in blood and terrible sacrifice of the United States. It was a kind of reinvention. It created the Second American Republic in those constitutional amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th. And for the next century, we struggled, to say the least, we struggled to make those legacies good and couldn't. And, of course, it's in part why we had the Civil Rights Movement. So whenever a nation undergoes this kind of transformation, its legacies and its memory will probably forever be vexing. And it's probably the reason we're still here talking about it.
You can listen to that entire program on dianereem.org. That's our show for the week. Let us know what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, or send us an email at drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harton. It comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. I'm Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.